As Sammy asked, I will ask as well, if people could please, for those who feel comfortable, turn on the video so that I could actually speak to people. That's always much better than looking at gray screens. As I said before, you know, when we started the program, Congregation B'nai Torah is dedicated this evening for the art site of and in memory of Paul Forman, Pesach David ben Avram, Zichrona Levracha. And I'm not going to recount the speech that I gave at the outset, but again, just to say, a man with a tremendous, tremendous heart, and somebody who I miss, and I know many people here miss. I also want to make sure to make special mention of some people who are here, I'm not going to name you, who learned the Book of Shmuel with me, or have learned part of the Book of Shmuel so far with me, because this class that we're going to have now, the session that we're going to have, is based on ideas that we developed together. So I'm grateful for your help in developing what we're going to be saying this evening. For those who have not yet downloaded the source sheet, please do so. The top set of links on the source sheet are to sessions I've given that give a little more depth on what we're going to be covering in the next 28 minutes or so. So what I want to do tonight, our topic is Zachor, when Shmuel executed Eichmann, is look at the story of Shaul's war with Amalek, as recorded in the 15th chapter of the book of Shmuel Aleph, Samuel. And I want to address the following four questions. No, it's Purim, not Pesach. Four questions can still be asked. It doesn't make a difference. Number one, why did Shaul, King Shaul, spare Agag, the king of Amalek? Number two, when it came time to execute Agag, why did the prophet Shmuel execute Agag personally instead of ordering King Shaul to do it? Why did Shmuel make a speech before he executed Agag? And at the end, what does all of this have to do with Adolf Eichmann, Yimach Shemo? So there's an awful lot to talk about. Let's get going by looking at the story in chapter 15 of Shmuel. And again, it's there on the source sheet. In the source sheet, I gave you Hebrew as well as the JPS translation. Not because I favor the JPS translation, but because it has the advantage of being cut and pastable for free from Sfaria.org. And that's the way it works. Publishing always wins. So, if you take a look at source number one, I'm going to work with the English translation that's there on the sheet. I may make some references to Hebrew here and there. Samuel said to Saul, I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. By the way, it just occurred to me that I didn't take the time to mention. This is the Haftarah for the Shabbos before Purim. The most obvious reason why it is the Haftarah for the Shabbos before Purim is because Haman traces to Agag in the Megillah, and this is a story involving, indeed, King Agag of Amalek. Okay, so Shmuel said to Shaul, I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. Here's your mission. Listen to the Lord's command. Thus said the Lord of hosts, I am exacting the penalty for what Amalek did to Israel, for the assault he made upon them on the road on their way up from Egypt. Now is time for Amalek to pay the price for their attack on the Jews in the wilderness. So go, attack Amalek, and proscribe. Proscribe is a great word. Has no meaning here. Hacharamtem in the Hebrew is the word you want. It means destroy, eliminate all that belongs to him. Spare no one, but kill alike men and women, infants and sucklings, oxen and sheep, camels and donkeys, everything. All has to be destroyed for reasons that we're going to have to come back to and discuss. But that's the command that Shmuel conveys to the anointed one of God, to King Shaul, to King Saul. Source number two, the chapter continues. Saul mustered the troops and enrolled them at Tla'im. He counted them. 200,000 men on foot, 10,000 men of Judah. The fact that we break out Judah from everybody else is an interesting point, but not for the discussion right now. Then Saul advanced as far as the city of Amalek and lay in wait in the Wadi. Saul said to the Canaanites, a nation, a tribe that is living among Amalek, but they are not of Amalek. They may even have been quasi-Jewish. So he says to them, come, withdraw at once from among the Amalekites, that I may not destroy you along with them. You showed kindness to all the Israelites when they left Egypt, an allusion to the fact that the Canaanite's ancestor is supposed to be Yitro, Moshe's father-in-law. So you were good to the Jews when they left Egypt, so we're going to spare you. Just move away from Amalek. So the Canaanites withdrew from among the Amalekites, proving once again they know where the they know a good move when they see it. Saul destroyed Amalek from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is close to Egypt. Okay? Picture that in your head, please, because the location matters. Okay? From Havilah to Shur, close to Egypt. Right? Southwest Israel. And he captured King Agag of Amalek alive. He proscribed, there's that word again, he destroyed all the people, putting them to the sword. But Saul and the troops spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the second born. Mishnim, he's rendering as second born. That's interesting. Mishnim could mean a lot of different things. We'll leave it as second born for now, but know that that's not necessarily the translation that all would use. The lambs, and all else that was of value. They would not proscribe them. They proscribed only what was worthless. In other words, they destroyed the animals that were no good. They kept the animals that were good, but not for themselves, as we're going to find out. Source number three. Are we good so far? Okay, this is straightforward. We're just reading a story. So the word of the Lord then came to Samuel. I regret that I made Saul king, for he has turned away from me and has not carried out my commands. God says to Samuel, Saul blew it. Tell me something at this point in the story. How has Saul blown it? What has Saul done wrong? Based on what we've already read.
Left Agag alive.
He left Agag alive. Okay, what else?
He kept some of the sheep for himself.
Right.
And he didn't kill him.
Well, not for himself necessarily, but he keeps some of the animals alive and he keeps King Agag alive. That's correct. God didn't say that to Samuel, though. God just says to Samuel, your guy blew it. I'm a little cavalier with that, sorry. Samuel was distressed. He entreated the Lord all night long. Shmuel is very, very upset. Don Isaac Abarbanel explains, Shmuel is upset because Shaul is his handiwork. Shaul is his legacy. Shaul is the king he built up and placed in front of the Jews. And now, he's gone. God said, enough. He turned away from me. He did not carry out my commands. Well, his plea to God all night long is unsuccessful. Take a look at source number four. Early in the morning, Shmuel went to meet Shaul. Shmuel was told, oh, Shaul went to Carmel, where he erected a monument for himself. Now, that doesn't have to be a monument. Various commentators render it as a mizbeach, as an altar. Then he left and went on down to Gilgal. Pause here, once again. Where is Carmel in Israel? Where is the Carmel?
To the north.
Right, I see Izzy pointing up. That's correct. Carmel is way up north. Unless you say that it's just a region of soft produce, and you could take Carmel to mean that, but generally we assume when you talk about the Carmel, you mean a region way up north. Where is Gilgal? Where is Gilgal in Israel?
It's to the east by the Yarden.
To the east by the Yarden, the first place the Jews camped when they crossed the Jordan, right? Near Jericho, right near Jericho. So he's doing a tour, right? He's going all over the place. His war took place down south in the southwest. Then he goes up north. Then he's going east over to Gilgal. Interesting. Well, Shmuel catches up with Shaul. And Saul says to him, ho, blessed are you of the Lord. I have fulfilled the Lord's command. Then what, demanded Shmuel, is this bleating of sheep in my ears and the lowing of oxen that I hear? And you can't talk about this without doing the pun that you have within the text, where Shmuel says to Shaul, Umeh kol hatzon hazeh be'oznai. What is this sound of the sheep? Meh. What is this meh sound of the sheep? Especially if you lane it with the tevir, which it's supposed to have. Umeh. That's the way it's supposed to be done. If you're in Shul the Shabbos and you hear the Haftarah, if you merit to be one of the ten, then you can comment on it then. So, what is this bleating of the sheep? Why do I hear animals? Shmuel says to Shaul. You said you did everything, but there aren't supposed to be any animals here. This ain't a petting zoo. What's going on? Shaul answered, they were brought from the Amalekites, the troops. Ha, the troops. Spared the choicest of the sheep and oxen for sacrificing to the Lord your God. And don't worry, we proscribed the rest. We destroyed the rest of them. We just kept these as karbanot. We brought them as sacrifices to God. So Shmuel's clearly not getting through. He says, let me try again. We're in source number 5, top of the second side. Shmuel said to Shaul, stop. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Speak, he replied. Remember, Shaul is still the king. He gives you permission to speak. So he says to Shmuel, go ahead. So Shmuel says, you talk about the troops telling you what you have to do. You should leave the animals alive. You may look small to yourself, but you are the head of the tribes of Israel. The Lord anointed you king over Israel. The Lord sent you on a mission saying, go and proscribe the sinful Amalekites. Make war on them until you have exterminated them. Why did you disobey the Lord and swoop down on the spoils in defiance of the Lord's will? Why did you leave these animals alive? Notice, by the way, he has not mentioned anything about King Agag. Why has he not mentioned anything about King Agag? Right, Leona says, because he doesn't know. He heard the animals mooing and making whatever sounds they're making. He hasn't heard Agag's making a peep. He doesn't know about Agag. So he says, what did you do? So Shaul says back to Shmuel in source number 6. Shaul said to Shmuel, but I did obey the Lord. I performed the mission on which the Lord sent me. I captured King Agag of Amalek, and I proscribed Amalek, and the troops took from the spoil some sheep and oxen, the best of what had been proscribed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. He says, I did everything that I was supposed to do. Hey, did I mention I spared Agag? Right? It's like he doesn't even know he's done something wrong. It's like, look, here's the proof that I did what I was supposed to do. We brought back animals to sacrifice, and I spared Agag. So, Shaul really doesn't necessarily think he's done anything wrong with Agag. And we're going to have to come back to that and unpack that. But that's a key point here. Take a look at source number 7. We're continuing in this story. Shmuel says to Shaul, he's still on track with the animals. He says to Shaul, does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obedience to the Lord's command? Surely obedience is better than sacrifice, compliance than the fat of rams. Rebellion is like the sin of divination, right? Of reading signs from other gods and supernatural forces. Defiance is like the iniquity of Teraphim, also calling on supernatural forces. Because you rejected the Lord's command, he has rejected you as king. That's it. Your reign is over. Obedience is what God wants. Sacrifices are not the goal. Obedience, if anything, is a prerequisite for sacrifice. Well, Shaul says to Shmuel in source number 8, I did wrong to transgress the Lord's command and your instructions. I was afraid of the troops. I yielded to them. Please forgive my offense. Come back with me. I will bow low to the Lord. I'm going to make it right. And Shmuel says to Shaul, I'm not going with you. You have rejected the Lord's command, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel, breaking Shaul's heart in a very substantive way. If you learn Shmuel more and you look at the events of this chapter and the next chapter, you can see how devastated Shmuel is to have to say this. Then you get source number 9. And source number 9 is the conclusion. Shmuel said, bring forward to me King Agag of Amalek. Agag approached him with faltering steps. And there's some debate as to how to translate the Hebrew word ma'adanot, but this is one translation. Agag said, bitter death is at hand. And Shmuel said, as your sword has bereaved women, so shall your mother be bereaved among women. And Shmuel cut Agag down before the Lord at Gilgal. There's more to the story, of course, after this. But now, again, I ask my questions. Why did Shaul spare Agag? Clearly, he thought that what he did was right, or he wouldn't have boasted about it to Shmuel. That's number one. Number two, why did Shmuel insist on executing Agag personally instead of ordering Shaul to do it? He could have told Shaul, finish the job you started. And why does he insist on making a speech? And again, what does this have to do with Eichmann? So in order to understand this, we have to understand why war with Amalek has the rules that we've seen here. That word that JPS keeps repeating, proscribe, proscribe, proscribe. Why are we proscribing everything in this war with Amalek? What's this about? Well, there are three different ideas found in the writings of our sages to try to explain this, all of which trace to the biblical account of Amalek's attack on the Jews. The first approach to explain why Amalek is different, and there's going to be a poll on this in a few minutes, so listen carefully, please. I learned how to use polling in Zoom today, and I'm very excited. It's my new toy. So, the first approach, Amalek is different because of their personal character. They attacked us from behind, unplanned, they happened to see us, unprovoked, we're not coming their way, we didn't start with them. This is the cruelty we identify with Amalek. If you take a look in source number 10, you find from the Torah portion of Ki Teitzeh, when we read the Parsha of Zachor, the Shabbos, that's what we're going to be reading from. I put the link for the source sheet in the chat again, because I see some people have joined since I last posted it. This is the reading of Zachor. Zachor es asher asah lecha Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt. How, undeterred by fear of God, he surprised you on the march when you were famished and weary, and he cut down all the stragglers in your rear. Amalek came up and attacked you, unprovoked, and as they translate the text, the literal read of the text, when the text says, not God-fearing, it's describing Amalek, not us. It's saying Amalek lacked fear of God, and they attacked you. They attacked the stragglers. That's the cruelty of Amalek. And so Don Isaac Abarbanel, as well as the Malbim, who Rabbi Bergman quoted, take the view that Amalek is proscribed, as we put it, as JPS put it anyway, because of their unusual cruelty. They are more cruel than everybody else. We have laws that govern the way we fight a war. We would never be allowed in a regular war to do what we do with Amalek, what we're commanded to do with Amalek. That kind of wholesale destruction, generally speaking, is off limits. Amalek, though, they're unique in their cruelty. That's one approach. Second approach, it's about their relationship with God. If you take a look in source number 11, the Hebrew's in the bottom of one side, the English is the top of the next side, you get the account of Amalek's attack in the Parsha of Bishalach. We read it in Shul not that long ago. This is Hashem's speech to Moshe after that war with Amalek. The Lord said to Moses, inscribe this in a document as a reminder. Read it aloud to Joshua. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. God says, I am going to blot out the memory of Amalek. And Moses built an altar, named it Hashem Nisi, and he said, this means hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages. The message that you draw from this account, the message that we get from the version in Bishalach, is that this is a personal war between God and Amalek, because it's about their relationship. What is it in their relationship? Go back to source number 10. We said there, the fact that they have no fear of God. Lo yarei Elokim. And so God says, you shall eradicate them. And specifically, we said back in source number 10, at the end of the source, mitachan hashamayim, from beneath the heavens. And this view that the problem with Amalek is their relationship with God leads commentators to read all sorts of philosophical sins into the behavior of Amalek. Whether it's the very simple and straightforward that they attacked us when everybody was afraid in order to defuse everybody's awe of God, which Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra suggests, or whether deeper views about their philosophy, they believe that everything in the world should be random and God should not be involved in the events of this world, all the different sins that are associated with Amalek stem from this view that it's about their relationship with God. That's why they're different. Clear so far? We're good? That's the second view. Then the third view is that it's about Amalek's historical hatred for us. If you take a look back in source number 10, the fact that they chose to attack the stragglers behind you when you were famished and weary, this description is not only of a nation that is cruel, but a nation that is cruel to us. And we have this in Tanakh. Amalek attacks us repeatedly. It's not only that one time in the wilderness. We have many battles with Amalek in which they engage in cruelty, and our sages trace this to their genealogical roots. Who is the original Amalekite? What was his genealogy? What's his family role? Who is he?
He was from
Esav. He was Esav's grandson. His son's son, the firstborn. The firstborn son of his firstborn son. The son, it's Esav, then Eliphaz, and then Amalek. He is Esav's grandson. That's one side. And who is his mother? Who is the mother of Amalek? A woman by the name of Timnah. And while the Medrash on this is too elaborate to go into and explain here, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Sanites, Amud Beis explains that Timnah was actually the head of a clan. She was part of a leading clan, Aluf Timnah. And then she became a concubine, as is described in the Torah, to Eliphaz. How is it that somebody from a royal clan became a concubine? Says the Medrash, because she wanted to join into the Jewish people. She wanted to be able to marry into the family of Avram, was rejected. Family of Yitzchak was rejected. And so because she was rejected, she said, fine, I'm going to join Esav. And that leads to great hatred from her for the Jewish people, because we rejected her. And the Gemara brings it as part of a polemic against rejecting those who want to join us. And so the third school of thought says that it's the hatred for us that Amalek has that singles them out for this destruction, because you can't leave them alive. So I'm about to launch a poll here. Why does the war with Amalek have special rules unlike those of any other war? This is multiple choice. It's anonymous. You can choose whichever answers you want. You click on as many as you like. Is it Amalek's personal character, Amalek's relationship with God, or Amalek's hatred for us? Or you can click other. I know at least one person here is going to click other. I give you another 30 seconds. No, I'll give you 20 seconds. Doesn't take that much time to answer one question. And then I'll end it and we'll see what the results are. Which of these explanations most appeal to people? Okay. Sorry? You don't have to tell me. It's anonymous. Okay, I'm ending the poll. And the results are that we have 74% of respondents said Amalek's hatred for us. 47% said it's Amalek's relationship with God. 44% said it's Amalek's personal character. And a couple of people suggested other. In any case, the point is that all three approaches are seen in our sages and are anchored in the text, in the Torah, describing the original attack on us. Well, all of this is what leads to the instruction to destroy Amalek entirely. Don't take any spoils. I brought you Don Isaac Abarbanel in source number 12, in which he says, lest one think this war was like other wars, to take spoils, take them as slaves. He ordered him. Shmuel orders Shaul, destroy everything Amalek had. Destroy everything. Much as Abarbanel notes, in Megillat Esther, we don't take the spoils. A war against Amalek has to be marked as different from other wars. And now I understand what happened with Shaul. Shaul didn't get that. Shaul thought, I'm doing a good thing. All you want is that all the animals are dead and that Agag is dead. I have a better way to do it. I'm going to keep the animals for sacrifices. We're going to kill the animals. But it's going to be as a sacrifice to God. And Agag? We're going to take Agag on a tour around the country to show everybody what has happened. Source number 13, Don Isaac Abarbanel. He did what kings do. He took Agag, the enemy king, around the country alive in order to mock him. That's why he started out with a war down south. Then he went all the way up north to the Carmel. And then he went east to the Gilgal. It's a victory parade. That's what he's doing. And he's planning to execute Agag. And that's why he thinks he's done nothing wrong. Indeed, Malbim says the verb that's used in the Torah, Vayachmol Shaul al Agag, Chet Mem Lamed, means making a calculation, deciding, why should I destroy him? I can do better than destroying him. This will be an advantage. But this is disobedience. And that's how he loses the throne. Because Shmuel says to Shaul, that's not the way it works. What you've done is you've destroyed the whole aspect of this war that was unique. Now it looks like any other war. We took spoils. Everybody takes spoils. We did a victory parade with the king. That's what everybody does. David does it with Goliath. After David kills Goliath, he takes his head around the country and does a tour. That's what this looks like now also. You've ruined it, Shmuel says to Shaul. And that's why Shmuel has to kill Agag himself and not let Shaul do it. Because the point wasn't Agag's death. The point is how he will die. It has to be in a circumstance that makes it not a normal war. People have to understand what this war with Amalek is all about. It's their unique cruelty. It's their relationship with God. It's their hatred for us. And maybe that's why Shmuel not only executes him, but gives a speech first. It's a speech of righteous indignation and divine justice. This isn't personal. This isn't a war of conquest and enrichment. This is a war of God. Different story altogether. And that brings me to the last of our questions, the Eichmann connection. When Eichmann was captured and then tried and sentenced to death, Professor Yitzhak Ben Zvi, President Yitzhak Ben Zvi was approached for clemency by Eichmann's wife. And if you look on your source sheet, you'll see it on the back page. This is unbelievable. This is, somebody scanned it in, the rejection of clemency by President Yitzhak Ben Zvi. So you can see in the body of the text, her appeal for mercy, which someone translated for me, and I was grateful to them for doing so. But basically saying, you know, he has a family, he has a wife, you should have mercy on him, you should spare him. And you look in the upper right-hand corner and you see the note that President Ben Zvi attaches to this. He quotes our pasuk, "Kasher shikla nashim charbecha kein tishkal mi nashim imecha." Exactly what we read a couple of minutes ago in Shmuel. The passage was in source number 9. As your sword has bereaved women, so shall your mother be bereaved among women. He gives you the reference to Shmuel Aleph. He gives credit right after that to somebody else before him, Dr. Nurak, who had made this association as well. And by invoking Agag, he says, we're not going to have any mercy on Eichmann. Because as with Agag, in a normal situation, if this were a normal criminal, yeah, you can have clemency on somebody for the sake of his family. But Amalek and these latter-day Amalekites are a different breed of foe. And the execution has to reflect that. It reminds me, actually, of Begin rejecting reparations. Rejecting reparations from the Germans, because he doesn't want it to look like spoils and like any other situation. He was of the same mentality. The lessons we take from here, to me, number one, we now understand the story better. We now understand Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tedvav, that chapter in Samuel, better. Number two, that the monarch is responsible to set a tone of following the divine instruction, and failure to do so is compared to sorcery and pursuit of foreign gods. Number three, regarding Amalek, there may be a foe who is so cruel and so awful that all the rules go out the window. Now, mind you, you need a prophet in order to identify that. This is a very dangerous game. If you don't have a Samuel to tell you that, you can't just do that on your own, make that decision on your own. And last, the lesson for all of us, like with Shaul, is that second-guessing God is a dangerous game. You don't necessarily grasp what's involved. Shaul thinks he knows better than the command, and he loses the monarchy for himself and his descendants as a result. I gave you review questions on the sheet. You can look at them later. But for now, it is 9:02, and definitely time for me to turn over the floor to Rabbi Alex Hecht. Thank you very, very much, and I wish you, granted COVID, nonetheless, as Rabbi Bergman said, this is a time for us to be happy despite everything that's going on. So I wish you a Freilich and Purim. Rabbi Hecht.
Thank you, Rabbi.